Let me summarize it this way. Solomon's temple was dwelt by the presence of the king. The whole point of this temple is not the temple. The whole point of this temple is whom this temple is for. They are building it as a place for God to dwell among his people. Remember, that was the point of the tabernacle too. Think back to Exodus. We're going to get there in just a little bit if you're in our Sunday school series. Where was the tabernacle located in the Israelite camp? At the very center, right? The dead center of the camp. All of the tribes were laid out in a certain pattern around it. But the tabernacle was at the center. Israel was to be God-centered and have God dwell in their midst. And this is making that arrangement permanent. From tent to house. From tabernacle to temple. And God stops the building project in the middle of everything. Hold it. Just to make this clear. The point of the temple of the king is not the temple of the king. It's the king of the temple. Now, I bet you can see all kinds of ways of applying that principle to your life today. For example, you and your body is a temple of the king. And that means that God dwells in you. That's amazing. And should be celebrated. But don't get to thinking that you're all that and a bag of chips. The point of the temple is the king. It's not the temple of the king. It's the king of the temple. Now we're going to see that this temple was amazing. Amazing. But it was going to be useless and meaningless without the Lord dwelling in it and blessing it. You have this glorious building, but if God doesn't actually live there, worthless. You see, the Israelites kept making this mistake with the temple. By the time of Jeremiah, they believed that nothing could touch their kingdom because they had the temple. They even had a slogan. You ready for the slogan? Here's what it was. The temple, the temple, the temple. That was their slogan. They were chanting it at all the football games, right? The temple, the temple, the temple. But the Lord was going to bring judgment on them because they had failed the test of verse 12. So they didn't get the blessings of verse 13. Look at verse 12 again. As for this temple you're building, if you follow my decrees, carry out my regulations, and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father. In other words, Solomon, you've got one job. Keep the covenant, leading others to keep it too. Solomon, you've got one job. Walk with God. If you do, then the Lord will dwell in the temple and all will be well. But if you don't, well, then there's going to be very negative consequences. I'm sure you can see the principle for our lives. We are not the king of Israel, the anointed king of Judah and Israel. But I think the principle is still true that God is calling each of us to walk with him in obedience. And that will connect us with blessing. Are you doing that? Are you walking with God? Are you obeying what you know of his will? Are you trusting in his promises and obeying his commands? Because that's where the blessing lies. That's the path to blessing. Not that we earn God's blessing by being obedient, no. But we connect with God's blessing through our obedience. We trust his promises and obey his commands, and we're happy in Jesus. Right? Trust and obey. There's no other way to be happy in Jesus than to trust and obey. Now in verse 14, the work commences again. God has spoken, and now we go back to the work, and the author gives us a glimpse inside of the temple. Now I never thought about this before, but one of the books I read this week pointed out that the average Israelite would never get inside this building, especially into the holiest place, right? So they would see it in Jerusalem. They'd be walking by and they'd see the outside, But they never got to see inside. That's just like us. That's why the author tells us so much about what it's like inside. He gives us a tour, an audio tour. And in a word, it's glorious. Look at verse 14. So Solomon built the temple and completed it. He lined its interior walls with cedar boards, paneling them from the floor of the temple to the ceiling, and covered the floor of the temple with planks of pine. He partitioned off 20 cubits at the rear of the temple with cedar boards from floor to ceiling to form within the temple an inner sanctuary, the most holy place. The main hall in front of this room was 40 cubits long. The inside of the temple was cedar carved with gourds and open flowers. Everything was cedar. No stone was to be seen. So all that stone, not a glimpse of it. This is a very finished building. He prepared the inner sanctuary within the temple to set the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord there. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 wide, and 20 high, a perfect cube. That's important in the Bible. It shows up again. He overlaid the inside with pure gold. And he also overlaid the altar of cedar. Solomon covered the inside of the temple with pure gold. And he extended gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary, which was overlaid with gold. So he overlaid the whole interior with gold. He also overlaid with gold the altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary. Are you hearing a theme here? What word am I punching? Gold. In the inner sanctuary, he made a pair of cherubim. These are fierce-looking angels, okay? Fierce-looking angels of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. That's 15 feet high. 15 feet high angels. One wing of the first cherub was 5 cubits long, and the other was 5 cubits, 10 cubits from wingtip to wingtip. The second cherub also measured 10 cubits, for the two cherubim were identical in size and shape. The height of each cherub was 10 cubits. He placed the cherubim inside the innermost room of the temple with their wings spread out. The wing of one cherub touched one wall, while the wing of the other touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. He overlaid the cherubim with gold. On the walls all around the temple, in both the inner and outer rooms, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. He also covered the floors of both the inner and outer rooms of the temple with gold. I think I counted 17 times that the author uses the word gold in this chapter and the next. He covered the floors with gold. If you walked into the temple, you were stepping on a floor coated with gold. We're remodeling the basement of our home right now. We're trying to move the boys downstairs into a bigger bedroom while still having a guest room down there. And I've been looking at floor coverings at Carpet One and Lowe's. And the cheapest stuff makes me swallow hard. If my calculations are right, and that's nothing to go on, I grant. I think this is about 2,700 square feet of pure gold just in floor covering. Gold everywhere you look. Here's point three of three this morning. Solomon's temple was reflecting the glory of the king. There's all kinds of stuff going on here in the design of this temple. I don't comprehend it all. There's lots of symbolism here, like the cherubim and the palm trees and the flowers, and in the next chapter, the pomegranates and all this water and this lampstand and everything that's going on, the bread of the presence. At least partly, it's supposed to take you back to the Garden of Eden, where the cherubim guard the gate, and everything is lush and beautiful and alive and flowing and glorious. Verse 31. For the entrance of the inner sanctuary, he made doors of olive wood with five-sided jambs. And on the two olive wood doors, he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, and overlaid the cherubim and palm trees with beaten gold. In the same way, he made 4-sided jambs of olive wood for the entrance to the main hall. He also made 2 pine doors, each having 2 leaves that turned in sockets. He carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers on them and overlaid them with gold, hammered evenly over the carvings. And he built the inner courtyard of 3 courses of dressed stone and 1 course of trimmed cedar beams. The foundation of the temple of the Lord was laid in the 4th year, in the month of Ziv, in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, the 8th month. The temple was finished in all its details. According to its specifications, he had spent 7 years building it to reflect the glory of God. Can you imagine this building? Now, again, I'm not good at picturing things, but I pick up all this gold. It's pretty amazing. Now, I don't know if this helps you, but here is an artist's rendering of the temple from the ESV Study Bible. If you look in that Study Bible, it has this picture with a lot of the details, like the measurements and stuff in our measuring system, not cubits. The artist has to imagine lots of things to fill in the gaps, but I think he captures some of the amazingness of this building that took Solomon 7 years to complete. What skill, what craftsmanship, what beauty got worked into all of these details. Why? To reflect the glory of God. God is worth it, friends. There is no more precious metal than gold. And here it is just thrown around God's house. Right? Everywhere you look. What are the streets like in heaven? Paved in gold. Same idea here. You walk on it. It's so rich. You know, sometimes we make the mistake of calling church buildings God's house, like this one. Wonderful ministry tool our facility is. But this is not God's house. We are God's house as a church together, or as individuals. We are temples of God. But this temple was God's house. This was a special earthly headquarters authorized by God and built to reflect his glory. He deserved only the best. And all of that symbolism was pointing to him too. Friends, God deserves our worship. And God deserves our best as well. Are you giving God your best? Are you living your life with excellence because you're living it for him? He is glorious. In chapter 7, it just gets more detailed. In chapter 7, we get the contents of God's house. We've heard about the outside dimensions and the inside coverings. Now here are the furnishings. Chapter 7, verse 1. It took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his palace. Now, some people think that Solomon has his priorities out of whack here. And that's possible. 7 years for the temple, 13 years for the palace. What's going on, Solomon? That's possible. If so, it's just a hint of that storm that is still to come in his life. But I'm not sure about it. The author doesn't make much of it, and it's really a description here of the rest of the temple complex because the palace is built right next door. It's kind of seamless. Verse 2. He built the palace of the forest of Lebanon, 100 cubits long, 50 wide, and 30 high, with 4 rows of cedar columns supporting trimmed cedar beams. It was roofed with cedar above the beams that rested at the columns, 45 beams, 15 to a row. Its windows were placed high in sets of 3 facing each other. All the doorways had rectangular frames. They were in the front part in sets of 3 facing each other. He made a colonnade, 50 cubits long and 30 wide. In front of it was a portico, and in front of that were pillars and an overhanging roof. He built the throne hall, the hall of justice, where he was to judge, and he covered it with cedar from floor to ceiling. And the palace in which he was to live, set farther back, was similar in design. Solomon also made a palace like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had married. All these structures from the outside of the great courtyard and from foundation to eaves were made of blocks of high-grade stone cut to size and trimmed with a saw on their inner and outer faces. The foundations were laid with large stones of good quality, some measuring 10 cubits and some 8. Above were high-grade stones cut to size and cedar beams. The great courtyard was surrounded by a wall of 3 courses of dressed stone and 1 course of trimmed cedar beams, as was the inner courtyard of the temple of the Lord with its portico. Now, as beautiful as that is, and as much work as it took to create, it wasn't covered with gold like the Lord's house was. And Solomon only got the best of craftsmen. Verse 13, King Solomon sent to Tyre and brought Huram, whose mother was a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, so she was half Israelite, and whose father was a man of Tyre and a craftsman in bronze. Huram was highly skilled and experienced in all kinds of bronze work. He came to King Solomon and did all the work assigned to him. Here's what he did. He cast two bronze pillars, each 18 cubits high and 12 cubits around by line. He also made two capitals of cast bronze to set on top of the pillars. Each capital was 5 cubits high. So that's high. It's like 35 feet high. These pillars with these capitals, which I don't know what that is. It's like a cap on the top. A network of interwoven chains festooned the capitals on top of the pillars, 7 for each capital. He made pomegranates in 2 rows encircling each network to decorate the capitals on top of the pillars. He did the same for each capital. The capitals on top of the pillars in the portico were in the shape of lilies, 4 cubits high. On the capitals of both pillars, above the bowl-shaped part next to the network, were the 200 pomegranates in rows all around. He erected the pillars at the portico of the temple. The pillar to the south he named Jachin, which means established, and on the one to the north, Boaz, which means mighty. The capitals on top were in the shape of lilies, and so the work on the pillars was completed. He made the sea of cast metal. This is this great big basin, okay? There was a little basin with the tabernacle. There's this great big basin with the temple. Circular in shape, measuring 10 cubits from rim to rim, and 5 cubits high. That's like 7 feet in the air. It took a line of 30 cubits to measure around it. Before the rim, gourds encircled it, 10 to a cubit. The gourds were cast in 2 rows in one piece with the sea. The sea stood on 12 bulls, 3 facing north, 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. The sea rested on top of them, and their hindquarters were toward the center. It was a handbreadth in thickness, and its rim was like the rim of a cup, like a lily blossom. It held 2,000 baths. That's not how many baths you can take in it. It's a measurement. It's 11,500 gallons. Okay? 11,500 gallons. And he also made 10 movable stands of bronze. Each was 4 cubits long, 4 wide, and 3 high. This is how the stands were made. They had side panels attached to uprights. On the panels between the uprights were lions, bulls, and cherubim, and on the uprights as well. Above and below the lions and bulls were wreaths of hammered work. Each stand had 4 bronze wheels with bronze axles, and each had a basin resting on 4 supports cast with wreaths on each side. On the inside of the stand, there was an opening that had a circular frame 1 cubit deep. This opening was round, and with its base work, it measured 1.5 cubits. Around its opening, there was engraving. The panels of the stands were square, not round. The 4 wheels were under the panels, and the axles of the wheels were attached to the stand. The diameter of each wheel was 1.5 cubits. The wheels were made like chariot wheels. The axles, rims, spokes, and hubs were all of cast metal. Each stand had 4 handles, one on each corner, projecting from the stand. At the top of the stand, there was a circular band, 0.5 cubit deep. The supports and panels were attached to the top of the stand. He engraved cherubim, lions, and palm trees on the surfaces of the supports and on the panels in every available space with wreaths all around. This is the way he made the 10 stands. They were all cast in the same molds and were identical in size and shape. And I know there's a lot of details here, but the only way we'll get it is by reading it, right? We can't see it. There are no pictures. We've got to read it and try to get it into our brain. He then made 10 bronze basins, each holding 40 baths and measuring 4 cubits across, 1 basin to go on each side of the 10 stands. So these are kind of like mobile water stations, okay? Not a wheelbarrow, okay, but like this great big bowl that sits on a stand so they can move the water throughout the temple because they're on rollers, okay? He placed 5 of the stands on the south side of the temple and 5 on the north. He placed the sea on the south side at the southeast corner of the temple. He also made the basins and shovels and sprinkling bowls. So Huram finished all the work he had undertaken for King Solomon in the temple of the Lord. The two pillars, the two bowl-shaped capitals on top of the pillars, the two sets of network decorating the two bowl-shaped capitals on top of the pillars, the 400 pomegranates for the two sets of network, two rows of pomegranates for each network, decorating the bowl-shaped capitals on top of the pillars, the 10 stands with their 10 basins, the sea and the 12 bowls under it, the pots, shovels, and sprinkling bowls. All these objects that Hiram made for King Solomon for the temple of the Lord were of burnished bronze. So, I know that's a lot. The inner temple is all made of gold, right? And then these things that Hiram makes are made of bronze. Now, why the difference? I think as you move away from the Holy of Holies, it's still precious metal, or it's still metal, but it's not as precious. So there's this movement of holiness towards the Holy of Holies, and it's all bright and shiny, right? Bronze, okay? Whenever you shine light on it, there's reflection. Now, there are some things made of gold. The king had them cast in clay molds in the plain of the Jordan between Succoth and Zarethan. Solomon left all these things unweighed because there were so many. The weight of the bronze was not determined. Solomon also made all the furnishings that were in the Lord's temple, the golden altar, the golden table on which was the bread of presence, the lampstands of pure gold, five on the right and five on the left in front of the inner sanctuary, the gold floral work and lamps and tongs, the pure gold basins, wick trimmers, sprinkling bowls, dishes and censers, and the gold sockets for the doors of the innermost room, the most holy place, and also for the doors of the main hall of the temple. When all the work King Solomon had done for the temple of the Lord was finished, he brought in the things his father David had dedicated, the silver and gold and the furnishings, and he placed them in the treasuries of the Lord's temple. Okay, do you have a picture in your head? A little bit of one at least, right? Right? Oh, capitals. That's what you do, isn't it, Alan? You build these pillars and you put capitals on top of everything. Do you overlay them all with gold? Not all of them. Okay, all right. Bronze, bronze, bronze. More than can be counted. Gold, gold, gold. More than you will ever see in your lifetime. Imagine what it must have been like when the sun came out and shined on it, reflecting the glory of the king. And you know what? It's not enough. The only time in the New Testament that talks about the glory, this glory of Solomon's, was to say that it's nothing compared to what God does daily for the birds and the flowers. And all of that glory was just a dim shadow of the glory of God. And what did they do with all these gold instruments? What are the gold tongs for? What are the gold sprinkling bowls for? What is the golden altar for? It's for blood. It's for sacrifice. Because that's what took place in the tabernacle. And then now in the temple, the sacrifices to make things right with the king of the temple. Because of sin, there needs to be a sacrifice, which takes us to this table. Would the men come forward to help me? This table stands for the sacrifice. We're out of time this morning, or I would take you to Hebrews chapter 9, where the author starts to explain what some of these things in the temple stand for. And then he says, when Christ came as a high priest of the good things that are already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not man-made. That is to say, not a part of this creation. Jesus did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, having obtained eternal redemption. The blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they are outwardly clean. How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, so that we may serve the living God? That's what this table stands for. The perfect sacrifice that perfectly fulfilled what all of those sacrifices stood for. So that once and for all we are cleansed to serve the living God, our King. So as we eat this memorial meal, we celebrate His perfect sacrifice.